Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. I'm really excited today to have Zach on the show. Zach and I go back decades when he was running product marketing or product management at Borland. At the time, the leading Pascal, C, and then C++ compilers. And so I'm just thrilled to have you here, Zach. You've been part of so many amazing companies, and I think our audience is going to learn a lot from everything you've done in bringing products to market and competing and winning and losing and what we often do every day. And anyways, why don't you introduce yourself, Zach, to the audience, and then we can have a good chat.
Sure. Dean, good to see you again. It has been a while. So we both go back a ways. So we got some earned gray hair. And back when we were first met, that was the big migration to graphical environments. Yep. Windows 95, client server architecture, all that. And since then, I've had a very long career in tech, starting in product management, then moving up into marketing and management and COO, and worked in lots of interesting companies. And maybe one thing that I did differently than a lot of people is every new job I took, it was in a different area of technology. I didn't want to, like, having done tools once, I don't really want to do that again. So I went in and I was at a middleware company, Active Software, and we did an IPO, and that was a lot of fun. And then later I instead of doing another middleware company, I did an open source company. That was MySQL. And I ran product and engineering and marketing there. And then I went to Zendesk when that was a brand new thing. So I walked away from open source databases, although I got a lot of calls in that area. Then grew Zendesk. And of course, that was a very successful company worth like $12 billion. Then I was at Duo Security, brand new again. And I would go back to an early stage company doing $5 million and then start all over and do it again. And now I'm at a company called Crescendo.ai. And I think AI is just this amazing potential technology that might be bigger than all those other waves before.
Yeah.
But we don't know.
No doubt about that. And maybe just to even start off, we'll talk about AI, but what are some of the big lessons that you've learned? Scaling companies hard, you're at some really great brands, and it's so hard to grow and scale from 5 million and keep trying to double. And what are some good lessons you could share with our audience?
So there's no easy lesson, that's for sure. And so I've been writing a little bit about this and taking inspiration from your book. I've been working on a book, and right now it's just a blog. It's on Substack. It's called buildtoscale.substack.com. And I was writing weekly, but now I'm in a full-time job. It's monthly is about as good as it gets. But one of the things that's a little paradoxical for startups is often startups try to do too many things. They try to be all things to all people. And of course, if you ask a developer, can you guys do this? Yeah, we could do that.
Yes.
It's just software. We can make it do anything. But the irony is you actually have to be laser focused in the early days of a business and really be clear. We do this one thing. We do it better than anybody else, but it's not for everybody. And if you can identify who is your ideal customer, what's the pain that they have, and if you solve that pain, you know, you're going to get a meeting, they're going to engage, they're going to want to try your software. But if you don't solve that person's pain, go look somewhere else to solve somebody, find out who has that pain. And again, sometimes I try to be generous of my time to founders because it really is hard to build a business at scale. And often I find, particularly engineers, they'll go spend a year working on something and then they launch it and they're like, no, nobody's coming. What happened? It's go talk to people. Don't just assume because you think it's a problem for them. And so I encourage people to do a lot of active listening. Go out, don't do a demo. Don't tell them what you built. Don't tell them where you came from. Just sit down and interview them. And I always try to, I'll have a sheet of paper. I'll ask them the same 8-10 questions and ask them about their last project. What went right? What went wrong? What were the surprises? What took longer? And then you start to understand the real problems they have versus that thing. Yeah, that takes me 15 minutes a week. I don't really care. But if you could solve this problem, then you've got my attention. And again, don't try to show them, don't demo your stuff. Because if you show people your stuff, it's like showing pictures of your children. Nobody's going to tell you you have an ugly baby. They'll say, oh, that's super interesting for the market.
Yes.
So in the early stage, focus is really important.
So what you said is maybe easy words, really hard to do. So like, how about when you're trying to find product market fit? So you built a piece of software and you studied and interviewed the market and who your ideal customer is. And, but then it still doesn't always go so easy. Like, how do you navigate from that point of you have something and then you start iterating and trying to figure out product market fit?
Product market fit is not binary, you know, all or nothing. It can be nothing. That's rarely 100%. So you got to be really honest with yourself about who really has the pain. And if you can get early customers paying you, I'm also a fan of don't worry too much if you leave money on the table. If it really solves a problem for them, lean into that. And then with those early customers, just say to them, look, I'm going to give you the introductory pricing. And maybe it's, you're making up a number at that stage, right? It doesn't really matter. They pay you $5K or $50K or $50. Okay, $50 might not work at scale. Get the adoption and then say, hey, part of this is I'm just getting going. And I'm going to, if we make you successful, I'm going to ask you for some referrals, like other people in your industry, maybe with your title, who have the same problem. And I'll ask you if you could introduce me to them, if we do a good job. And then make sure you follow up and do that and get the first 10, the first 20, the first 30 customers. And at that stage, it is founder selling. Really, it's got to be solving the problem and sometimes identifying people who are willing to take a risk on an early stage company. And the only reason they're going to do this is because the problem you solve for them is so big that they're desperate. Because it's not rational for a big company to buy from a startup. It's you only do it out of desperation. But I remember at Zendesk, for example, every week I'm thinking about how do I get more leads into the funnel? And we had a very successful high growth business, but I'm always looking for more leads. And a guy, he was had this startup, he was a very analytic guy. It was this early stage startup. He sent me an email and he said, hey, we're doing this work for Box. And Box suggested I talk to you. And it basically does automatic scoring to find lookalike customers for, and by the time I get to the end of the email, I'm like, come in tomorrow. If this thing does what you say it does, I am interested. He came in the next day. We're like, okay, if you can make this work, we will buy. And I laid it out. I said, you got 30 days or 60 days or whatever it was. And he said, hey, we have to crank on your data. And they had to make sure it was a large enough data set to see who has bought from you in the past. Now we're going to go find those lookalike people going forward. And it was fantastic. And I said to him, like, hey, we're not going to be your best paying customer, but I'll give you three more references. The same way Aaron Levy at Box introduced him to us, I'll do the same thing. I'll introduce you to five other companies. Yeah. And it was a great product. It really helped us solve a problem that I felt we had, which was how do we tell the good leads from the bad leads? Because we had a lot of leads coming in, but they're not all good leads. And this was a fantastic tool for us. And we used it for many years. And then when I went to Duo Security, we used the same tool and kept going with it. Eventually, they changed their business, so they moved in a different direction, which was unfortunate because I thought it was really a terrific product.
Yeah, that's great. What kind of advice do you have when you're like, there's already tools solving a problem in the market, but you're innovating and there's a better way? And so you almost have to like educate the market about a better way that you can, you know, increase, scale your business. Or if you use this software, do you have any advice around that where you're actually helping the customer understand that there's a better way and how they're doing it today, even though they feel it's their problem solved, there's a better way?
Yeah. So most of the businesses that I've been a part of where they've been very successful, they were in an existing large market. So Zendesk wasn't the first help desk software. MySQL wasn't the first database. Duo Security wasn't the first two-factor. Crescendo AI is certainly not the first or last company in the customer service area to use AI. And all of them took a radically different approach. And as a result, they were disruptive of the industry. And being disruptive, and lots of venture capitalists and pundits use that word to mean newer, better, different. I use it in the sense of Clayton Christensen, which says you're disrupting the market from the, typically from the bottom up by changing the criteria to better serve the underserved market. So if you take the database industry, when MySQL was launching, there were lots of databases, Oracle, SQL Server, IBM DB2, Informix, you name it. And it was considered a saturated $30 billion market, and nobody would want to go compete with all those companies. Who wants to compete with Oracle and Microsoft and IBM?
Yeah.
We were able to do it because we said, hey, we're doing a completely different thing. You have a database for your transaction systems and systems of record and ERP systems. We're not that. We do this other thing. We're a really good web database. What's a web database? Oh, that's where blah, blah, blah. And then we would say how we were different. And we were fundamentally different in a couple of ways. Our architecture was different. So it was more of a scale out kind of database, meaning use lots of instances of MySQL. And it was also different because it was open source. And open source meant you could download it and use it for free, which is a hell of a business model when it works. We had this model, which today is called open core, but means there's a free database, but there's other things you can wrap around it that cost money. So we definitely had to educate the market, but we weren't going after existing Oracle DBAs saying, hey, you should switch databases. That's a hard slog.
That's smart. Yeah, that's tough.
We were creating or part of what became a brand new market. Now, it's hard to believe at this stage, Microsoft, IBM, Oracle, they weren't paying attention to the web as a market. Web development was a brand new thing. It was PHP, Perl, Python, and what became known as the LAMP stack, Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, Perl, Python. And yep. We were part of that LAMP stack. So we had to go educate people about the LAMP stack, or at least we had to find people who were interested in developing on that LAMP stack. And then say, hey, and they'd be like, how do I make my web application do this dynamic thing? You need a database. What's a database? Just download MySQL. And so we published a lot of content of how-to material, white papers, books. We went to conferences to show web developers how to use a database. And there was a whole other market of people who knew about databases who looked at MySQL and say, that's a toy. And yeah, okay, in the early days, it was a toy. But it was a really popular toy used by everybody. And all those developers then grew up using MySQL. And some use Postgres. That's an okay database too. But you have to educate and say, okay, who are we going after? Web developers. And our goal was to be the number one, the world's most popular web database.
Yeah.
Here we are, 2025. MySQL is not only that, it's the world's most popular database, period. There's Amazing. More instances of MySQL than Oracle or SQL Server or Postgres or anyone else, which is amazing.
Yeah. I know OpenAI is getting ready to actually put some of their models as open source. And do you have a point of view on that? And like, how can that, like, what kind of business strategy? I know if you put it out there as open source, like, you will get market awareness, market share. And, but then I think there's like even threats of misuse of it and what can happen.
Yeah, open source is a complicated beast, and it's not a business model, it's a distribution model. So you still have to say, how are we going to make money? And if it's like we give it away free and make it up in volume, that's tricky. We gave it away free, but there was also a commercial version that basically gave people more capabilities. And that wasn't crippleware or anything like that, but it was like the services to manage the database. So in AI, open source is used a little bit more loosely. So I know many of Facebook's announcements of open sourcing their AI models, they're like, it's open source with a big asterisk that says, in not every condition is it free. And so it's not, you could argue it's a different definition or it's a different meaning of open source. It's open, but not completely open. I get that. So I think we're really in the early stages of AI, and we don't yet know what business models will work. We don't know how many different LLM technologies there can be, there should be, there will be. We don't know, is it going to be like our business, Crescendo AI, we provide AI for customer service, but we provide it as a managed service, meaning we provide AI plus people. And that's a different approach than other people. Some people will just go sell AI bots, if you will. And other people will say, hey, we have an AI system, but it works with your others. So we'll have to see how it works. It is definitely the Wild West in the sense that there's a lot of funding out there, but we don't yet know what are the business models that will work. And having been through the industry's many ups and downs, as you have, Dean, at some point people will say, it's different this time. And sooner or later, it's not so different. You can't just take hundreds of millions of investor dollars and then lose money for years on end without having to show a business. So I suspect that some companies that get a little out there and try to spend their way too quickly, they may find themselves in a difficult position of they never built the discipline to build a business model. Yeah. Now, the counter argument people will throw out is Amazon lost money for many years. Salesforce lost money for many years. So I can lose money for many years. And the hard reality is most startups are not Amazon. They're not Salesforce. And the reason those companies could lose money is because their gross margins were good. They were profitable. They were spending money in areas where they could turn off that spending anytime they wanted to, and they could continue to grow maybe a little bit slower. They weren't losing money like selling dollars for 50 cents where you can never turn it to profitability. And my fear or suspicion maybe is there will be some AI companies who are just out there, their investors are telling them, pour gas on the fire, which generally speaking is not a good idea in the real world.
Yeah.
Pouring gas on a fire, you know, blows up.
Yeah.
So I'm always the guy in a company where I'm like, hey, let's make sure we can get to profitability. And one weird artifact of our business at Crescendo, we raised $50 million. We acquired a large BPO. We're cash flow positive. We're an AI company that's cash flow positive.
Wow.
Who's ever heard of that?
Yeah, it's like, I'm a little shocked that Cursor or Windsurf, not to belittle their technology, but like you have open source VS Code from Microsoft, and then you use some LLMs underneath, and then you're generating some code for developers, and which is always not so accurate either. But I don't even know if it's even true. Like how did they really went from two guys and scaled to hundreds of millions of dollars in ARR, and how OpenAI could offer $3 billion for these other. Can you make any sense of that?
When the market is frothy, here's a lesson for founders. When the market is frothy, it's better to be a seller than a buyer. So if those guys sold their company for $1 billion or $3 billion, hats off to them. They got a payday. We'll see. They can't all be worth $3 billion. You know what I'm saying? And we saw this in 1999 and 2000, where there were a lot of people caught with business models that didn't make sense. And suddenly the market shifted from valuing growth at any cost to you need to be profitable. And companies like Salesforce and Amazon, they're like, okay, we can slow down our growth rate. We can decrease our spend. We're fundamentally in positive gross margin territory. We can be profitable. And they were hugely profitable when they chose to be, do. But if you got the classic, what was it, pets.com, where you're selling dog food, and dog food weighs like, those are 20-pound, 50-pound bags. So shipping is non-trivial. And they're offering free shipping and they're losing money on every order. Yeah, that's not such a good business. But there will be some winners, but there may be more losers than winners when this account is written.
Now, how about everyone now is thinking and grappling with pricing for AI? So, do I charge for credits? Do I increase my annual subscription? Do I have a metering and not have a fixed subscription price for my customer if you go over it? Do you have any thoughts on how to? Because, like, it's like your shipping expense or your shipping scenario where no AI costs real money and the more usage costs more money. And so, how do you build that in so that you do have a profitable business model?
Yeah, and this is where I think a lot of venture dollars are basically subsidizing AI usage because AI is very computationally expensive. And so they're basically subsidizing it. And so companies that are built on some of those systems might not also be sustainable because at some point they're going to say, look, we have to raise our prices. And there's this knockdown effect of you built on a funny foundation, assuming it would be cheap forever. And it might not be cheap and it might not be sustainable. I think there'll be some experimentation in different models. I don't think we yet know. Sure, there's a model of saying it's like AWS, which means it's this complicated set of things, and you got peak hours and this kind of server and this much memory. And you're like, nobody really understands those AWS bills. And then another company comes along and says, hey, we can help you optimize your AWS bills. Okay, great. That just means it's too complicated. So AI might go down that path where it's this meticulously detailed thing, and then you need really phenomenal engineers or consultants to help you look at your spend to say, I don't want to be losing my shirt, and you'll figure out ways to pre-buy at discounts. And that can also lead to a problem because then you're over-consuming, but whatever. We're doing a different model at Crescendo AI. And I don't know if this will be applicable to other companies, but we're basically saying, look, we handle your customer service. Traditionally, in that area, you buy seats of Zendesk or Customer or Freshdesk, and you pay for labor. You hire CX people, customer service people, and you say, I need five people. And maybe you do it in-house, maybe you do it offshore. If you do it offshore, you use an outsourcer and you say, I need coverage by this many days of the week, this many hours, this many languages. And in Christmas, you're like, or Black Friday, you're like, okay, I know I'm gonna get 5x the number of inquiries. I'll double my staff, which means I'm never gonna get to all the questions, but that's all the budget I have. And we're doing a different approach. We're saying, hey, you just pay per outcome or incident. And whether we handle it through AI or through people, we handle it. And if the volume goes up, like we'll handle that. We can put a cap on how much you're spending and we'll put a threshold so that you don't get a surge spike that creates a surprising bill. And that might be a model for people who say, we care about the results of AI more than like the details of how many computations did you have and how many memory fetches or whatever. So I think there may be an opportunity for people to abstract out some of the complexity. I think there's going to be lots of experimentation, and we'll see in 5 years who built a good model.
I think it's interesting because, like, I was even talking to our guys the other day. Like, we always build stuff that's hard to build, and we compete against people that also know how to build hard stuff and are resourced and strong competitors. But there's probably so much white space out there where there's businesses and they don't know how to do technology. They certainly don't know how to build AI systems. And so I'm just reflecting on maybe what you guys are doing, that you chose to, hey, we can handle it for you. We know how to deal with technology, and there's both a managed service and people and tech. And I think it's pretty interesting what you're doing.
Yeah. And one of the reasons we're using this model is, this is my personal belief, that in any given market, there's complicated solutions, there are custom solutions, and then there's simpler solutions. Over time, simpler usually wins.
Yeah.
Because the early adopters like complexity and they can deal with that complexity. But as you get broader adoption, most people are like, I don't want to understand all this stuff. Just make it work. And SQL, like the Postgres guys used to complain, like, MySQL is too simple. That's our superpower. We make it easy. Yeah. We're not trying to do every corner case, every use case in the universe. But we do this one thing, web development, and we do a really good job of it. So if you're looking for, that's what we do. You can be up and running in 15 minutes.
Yeah, we tell you at Infragistics, we always talk about simple and beautiful, because when we deliver tools to developers, we want to help them build simple and beautiful experiences. And so, yeah, I can totally relate to that.
And that was the philosophy at Zendesk also, beautifully simple design. That was everything we did was about simplicity.
So easy to say, so hard to do. You have to, every day you have to be thinking about that.
Yeah.
And but the other thing too is, like, AI needs data, and I think that's the other thing that's like smart what you guys are doing, because it's hard to keep getting data, formatting it the right way to train the models. And so just being a SaaS company, you need to give the data is the customers, and they really want that privacy, but then you lose out on all that learnings and improvement and automation through the model. And it's interesting. I don't know if you guys, that's part of your strategy, but that's interesting.
I think that we might see a backlash over the next year or two, where, as we have with every new wave of technology, some early adopters get results, and then the next wave comes in and they don't get the same results. Maybe they don't have the right skills, or maybe they got sold a bill of goods. But I think what's going to happen is that AI is not a set it and forget it kind of technology. Like, you have to continue to invest in keeping the LLMs up to date, keeping the knowledge base up to date, tuning it based on changes in your policy or changes in your products or changes in your customers. But And if you don't plan for that, you're going to be one of those news stories. We saw one last week, AI making up a new policy because they didn't put the right guardrails around it. And irony of ironies, it was an AI company. And it's like, you guys should have known better. Come on. So
yeah,
there will be lots of success in AI, but it is not an easy to implement thing. You got to really think of how do I maintain this over the years? And do I have the talent in-house, or am I going to hire that talent? And am I going to help give people the time to do it? Or am I just going to throw another project their way and close my eyes to the risk that we didn't maintain this stuff?
Yeah, no, it takes a lot of skill, and everything's changing so much that you have to really keep up with everything to really deliver value and take a probabilistic technology and make it more deterministic. Like,
correct.
That's like kind of some of the things you talked about here. Like, you can't just have it make up a new policy. That's the way AI works probabilistically. And so you need those guardrails around it. And so
the guardrails are absolutely critical. Otherwise, like, I use AI for research, and sometimes I'll ask it a question and it'll say, oh yeah, there was an article published on this subject and this thing. And I look it up and there's no such article.
Yeah. It says it very convincingly too.
Yeah. Yes. That's the part where you're like, whoa, it's like an intern who really fast, but they just want to please you. And you'd be like, why did you make this up?
Yeah. I was just at the TED conference, and I love technology. But there were some really important AI pioneers, like, just saying how dangerous this is. Like, everyone's running so fast to bring product to market and get more capital and win market share. But the guardrails around, like, some of this technology is not quite there in terms of safety. And I don't know, do you guys talk about that at your company or?
Yeah. And it's for buyers, I can understand the dilemma. If you take the customer service industry, every customer service leader is under pressure to reduce budget and go deploy AI. And they don't want to be a laggard. You don't want to be saying like, maybe AI is a fad. Let me wait this out. It's not a fad. So there's pressure to get in and start getting results. So I think for a lot of people, the right approach is to say, look, do a phased introduction. As an example, we'll say, hey, we can put AI on your weekends and evenings coverage, because probably you don't have all the coverage you want for weekends and evenings. And it's hard to staff it and in multiple locations. Nobody wants to work weekends. And particularly if you're expanding into different markets geographically, and then you're like, I need somebody who speaks German and I need somebody who speaks this language and that language. It's like, you could get AI in a low risk place, let's say, and just start seeing, can I get good results with it? And generally speaking, the AI performs very well, but that way you build the confidence internally. You build, hopefully you have, if you're doing it yourself, you build the guardrails. If you're using somebody like Crescendo, okay, we build the guardrails and get that success and then go from there. But it's like, you don't want to spend like a year with a boil the ocean kind of approach that says everything's AI top to bottom and you're building it yourself and you spend a year or more and then you're like, okay, do I really have some results to show? I think going incrementally in some areas is a good approach.
Yeah, and even tech companies, you even have to build up AI skills. So, okay, you could not, that you may have the skills to do like RAG and stuff like that, but then the skills to, you know, do training and collecting data, and it's just different. Everything's different.
Yeah.
And so that's, so what other things could you share like around sales and marketing? Do you use AI a lot in your sales and marketing? And do you?
I think people have tried to use AI to replace salespeople or outbound SDRs, sales development reps. I'm pretty skeptical of those efforts. Certainly people should be using AI in their daily job. If it's creating content or looking, we use it in looking for trends among customer service incidents. How do you draw insights that you can bring back to the team? So I think on an individual level, everybody should be experimenting with AI, even if it's just ChatGPT to generate a first draft. When Midjourney started to take off, and the first time you see a Midjourney image, it's, wow, that is so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, 2025, I see a Midjourney image. I'm like, really? You cheaped out? You couldn't get a proper image? Because they all look the same. They all have the same vibe to it. And so AI, and I think the same is true for ChatGPT. If you try to use ChatGPT to write, you end up in this land of mediocre and you're not differentiating yourself. And so I think you have to have a judicious use of AI and say, I might use AI as a template, as a starting point. Same way if you use AI to generate code, like don't go into production with that code until you review it. And I've used AI to generate code for Sonic Pi, which is a music thing. And it does an okay job, but sometimes it's terrible. Sometimes it has bugs because I don't know where it got its code from, but maybe they weren't the best programmers. So I think you really have to test the heck out of AI anytime you use it. And AI is powerful, but without humans to review and curate, I think you're really putting yourself at a high exposure of things going wrong.
Yeah, totally agree. Someone that's with, so AI is real, but also AI is hyped. And it's, oh, now we won't need Hollywood actors. Oh, now we won't need this and that. But it's just, it has the promise of doing that, but it's not even close to doing
that. Yeah.
And so it's really about collaboration. So, okay, let's use AI to collaborate, to do whatever we're doing and improve it. It's at that level. But you have a lot of important people making these really high claims that is like driving the hype. Oh, we won't need software developers anymore. Not a chance.
Yeah, we've heard that for
in our lifetime.
We've heard that for three decades though, right?
Yeah, not a chance in our lifetime.
Correct.
And we're probably all going to live pretty long.
Yeah.
But then you hear, oh yeah, AI, I'm going to reduce my my engineering workforce, and because by the end of this year, I'll have an AI that can code at a mid-level. And no, it can help you and you can collaborate, but not a chance. And do you feel that way too?
Because yeah, I think there's, and some people, you got to question why they're talking about it. CEO of Klarna, he's used this to hype his company, but he's had to walk back a lot of those claims and say, okay, yeah, we are hiring humans. Yeah, no kidding. Have you tried AI? Like, you use Midjourney. So I wrote a book, I wrote a novel, The Man from Middlework. It's a World War II 1950s crime thriller. But then as Midjourney came out, I said, it'd be cool to create a graphic novel adaptation. And so I worked on that with the Midjourney. And sometimes it would produce a really good image. But most of the time, it takes 20 different prompts to get something that's usable. And often you get these pictures where it's got three arms or six fingers, or you say, hey, I want a picture of a 1950s style comic book with a soldier with a helmet and a scientist with a white coat and glasses. And then it produces a picture of five people in white coats and glasses. And I'm like, really? And it, or produce a soldier without a helmet. And it's like, come on. AI is just, it's cool what it does.
Yeah.
But it is dumb as a brick sometimes.
That's what I like. I'm into it. And I'm just like curious, like, how could it ever be AGI? Because it really is just a probabilistic model and guessing the right output. And it keeps getting better and better. But do you think the current tech could ever get to AGI?
I don't know. Because for 40 years, AI never lived up to any promise. And then for 5 years, it's done really good things. Now, is that 5 years going to continue for 10 or 15? Or do we revert back to never really lived up to expectations?
Yeah.
I'm optimistic. So I think it'll do new things. I think it'll get there. AGI, I think that's overstating it. But again, if you say it's like an intern with bad judgment that works really fast, but sometimes the work they do is absolutely incorrect. And can it get to mid-level? Yeah, maybe. But I think the mistake that people will make, and we see this maybe already, is overpromising, or as a result of the overpromising, expecting that it is going to perform as good as a human and just closing your eyes and saying, I let the AI do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You might not want to have AI do employee reviews, or you might not want to have AI determine like how to run a nuclear reactor.
Right.
If there's some data that's involved in analyzing, sure, it'll do a great job. But put a human in the loop there somewhere to oversee the results.
Yeah, definitely. I totally align with that. Yeah, I think people are afraid to give their real point of view sometimes because they don't want to seem like they're not in the know because AI is advancing. But then if you speak straight and keep up with AI where it's at, you wouldn't make some of these claims. But I don't think a lot of people want to do that. And I think people are getting some serious funding and valuations with all of this hype. So it's almost like also a marketing machine.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as you're in a company doing AI, and everyone in tech, and we're doing AI, no, there's some tremendous value to be created here and real solutions to deploy. It's really crazy. I've been part of this industry so long, so have you, but so it for me, it is the most craziest time of what's happening. And what else, like, what would you want to share with the audience? Like, I didn't ask you a question that you said, oh, I wish Dean would ask me that question.
This is not exactly, it's maybe a lesson I've observed in big companies. Sometimes, and it's related to this discussion around AI, you have to be willing to speak truth to what's going on. And sometimes in big companies, there's this kind of notion of nobody wants to call out, hey, something isn't working. And what I think is often really valuable is that the people close to the issues, customer support people, developers, salespeople, they know what's really going on in a company. And when a company screws up big time, sometimes it's because the execs don't know what's going on. Sometimes it's because they chose not to know what's going on. But if you're one of those people like the developers and somebody's saying something that's not true, you need to put up your hand and tell them, hey, I know you want to tell the shareholders this product is coming in Q4, the rate of bugs that we have, there's no way we're going to make that date. So put the bad news out there, because then you can actually do something about it. And I think that's actually super important. And sometimes when companies go really awry on ethical issues, it's, or just, and we don't have to make it into a big ethical thing, but just saying they got surprised by bad news. There are people in the company who knew about the bad news, but you have built a system whereby they don't feel they can speak the truth, or you don't want to know the truth. Either of those situations is bad. So I always really try to be in touch with the people who are at the front lines doing things. And at MySQL, we had an expression, bad news is good news, because then we can do something about it.
Yes.
No news is bad news, where people don't share what's going on. And so I think when you're in a company, you want to think about how things are, not how things look. How will it look if we announce that the product's going to be late? The product's going to be late. It's not an issue. You're going to screw up, and you're going to have a bigger problem to deal with if you're not honest about it. And so I just always encourage people to, like, if you have the truth, and then you can say, look, left as it is, we're going to miss our date, or the quality isn't there, or whatever. But now we can figure out, have an open discussion. How could we fix it?
Yes.
Do we need to cut the features? Do we need to scale it back? Do we need to throw it out and start all over again? Because one of those scenarios is going to happen. If you're on this path and it's just not converging, like, you got a bigger problem, and people are sweeping it under the carpet because they don't want to be the bearer of bad news.
Yes.
But as a professional, if you're an engineer and you see these things, you should speak up about it.
Yep, that's great advice. It comes down to culture and some of the things we like to say, blameless problem solving, so that you share problems and you're not accusing people and creating that, like, safe environment to, yep, like, collaborate, and just because we're all in the problem solving business. And I think that was really good advice you gave. And it happens in small companies too, not just big companies. It's because people, they're afraid of some bad negative outcome. But in reality, as you said, eventually it comes out. And so you, yeah, might as well solve it earlier. Yeah, that's some really good advice. Now, how can people get in touch with you? I know you write a blog and you're doing some other things. How can people get in touch with your company, yourself?
So we're at crescendo.ai, and we have a lot of content on that site for people who are in the customer service industry who might be interested. I have the blog, buildtoscale.substack.com. And if people are interested in the book I wrote, that's at mzurlacher.com. So I actually wrote that book with my twin brother. His name's Michael. And so we went with MZ Urlacher. And I used to be on Twitter. I have left Twitter behind. It's not worth it anymore. So I'm not really on the social media that much anymore. But
that's great.
People can find me. And I always try to be generous of my time to founders and people who are building companies, because it's really hard. And I always think, if I can save somebody some time, and then when I get these questions, then I try to think, okay, how do I turn that into a repeatable article so that other people could read that and maybe get the benefit also?
Zach, I might have a few blog articles. I'm going to hit you up on some of our problems. So there may be
anytime,
some future blogs coming from us.
Cool.
Zach, it's been a real pleasure. Great chatting with you, and appreciate that you joining us today.
Yeah, and congrats on the book. It's a terrific book.
Oh, thank you. All right. Thanks, Zach.
Okay.
Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data-Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.